Thank you, Russell, for your kind words of introduction. I hope your expectations are not going too high after that. I try to live up at least to 5% of it. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon I was a bit late for the event, but still I could hear this very elegant argument between Mr. Hazlitt, Mr. Kirk, Mr. Kühnelt Ledin, and I had the impression that in spite of all diversity of opinion, there was a consensus, and to that consensus I would also agree and try to become a member of it. That is, that perhaps the question, is religion necessary to a regime of freedom, is slightly misleading, because it implies somehow that we have a choice of religion or not in introducing into a society. Now, that is, I believe, not quite so. So we have several phenomena which would induce such an assumption. Some of them also have come out this afternoon. When we use the term religion without further qualifications, as it had to be done in the debate this afternoon, we usually think of Christianity as the religion with which we have to deal. But that runs into difficulties because, as it was brought out, other countries which are not exactly Christian, in the upper class at least, but what we call ideological, have a sort of faith too, and we hesitate to call that faith religion. But we do not have to go even to communist regimes or anything like that. But we have highly sophisticated problems of that sort right here within America. We have, for instance, just now a God is dead movement, which seems to imply somehow that religion is dead. And one has to do without religion. And some of these theologians who present this movement take their cue from a German Protestant theologian, Bonhoeffer, a victim of Nazism, who said the most important thing about Christianity is that one has to get religion out of it. Because what he understands by religion is a dogmatic belief instead of faith in the existential sense. So the matter is a bit complicated. I do not want to go now into definitions of religion or anything like that. It would perhaps not be suitable to the occasion. But we should be aware that whatever we call it, religion or something else or non-religion, every society has a relation to the ground of its existence, let's call it neutrally that way, by expressing its attitude to that fundamental problem of human existence, that man does not exist out of himself, but out of a ground. And the varieties of existential modes which express submission to such a ground, obedience to it, or revolt against it, must have a name, so let us call them simply the various existential, the various attitudes toward the fundamental tension of existence between time and eternity. That takes the word God out of it, because the tension between time and eternity can also be experienced by people who vociferously explain that they don't believe in God, or that there is no God, and that God is dead, or some other form of agnosticism. The tension still is there. So in this sense, I should like now to rephrase perhaps a bit the problem for this evening, and instead of speaking about the uses of religion which we cannot define too well for society, and that religion is not always good for society, but it brings about all sorts of unpleasant things like wars of religion, crusades, inquisitions, and God knows what. It all has also been brought out this afternoon. Let us go a bit into the contemporary spiritual situation in that sense of how those attitudes are predominant toward the timeless, in the language of Eliot, since Mr. Kirk just mentioned Eliot, or of eternity, or of a realm of God, whichever formula suits anybody. One of the characteristics of our time, in this sense now, of such a spiritual situation, are very peculiar self-characterizations. It is always good if you talk about a society that you first start from the vocabulary in which it interprets it itself. And we have today very loud self-interpretations. For instance, that the man of our society in the predominant, intellectually and culturally predominant form is modern man and is secular man. There is one such term. Another term is that we are living in a post-Christian age, or that man has become immanentist, or we're living in an immanentist culture. Now, these are the terms which are perhaps the most frequently used to characterize the age in which we are living. Now, if we look them over, we will find that they all have some peculiar vagueness, which comes out as soon as one asks even the most elementary questions with regard to their meaning. For instance, when we speak of man as a modern man, the man of our time as a modern man, we must be aware that the term modern has been used in order to set the man of the time against something that has gone before, back to antiquity. Man is always modern insofar as, in his vocabulary, insofar as he is opposed to something which he considers to have gone before. So modern doesn't mean very much unless it is further filled up with meaning. The same goes for a phrase like a post-Christian age. Well, we are in a post-Christian age because we are, after all, are post-Christ. And where else should we be except in a post-Christian age? But if you go beyond that, you would have perhaps to reduce the word post-Christian age to the meaning of a lot of people do not pay considerable importance to church membership. That is all one can say. Or that they do not, that they are agnostics in the Enlightenment sense or something like that. And that this type of people are the socially, intellectually predominant ones, the ones who determine an intellectual climate. Even worse, we get into worse problems, we get when we speak of man as immanentist. Because here we run into the trouble that the word immanent is a correlative term which makes only sense in regard, in relation to the term transcendent, and unless there is a recognition of transcendence, there is no immanence. So a thing like an immanent world doesn't exist unless you have at the same time a world transcendent reality which is correlative to it. So here are correlative terms and one cannot very much do with it. But it is characteristic now, as we have to come back to that question right away, characteristic of the time that such terms which do not stand up to the most primitive questioning as to what they possibly could mean are the terms used for designating the character of an age. Now, I should like to oppose to these self-characterizations, I've given three such terms, three other terms which seem to be more relevant and partly coincide in content with what these other terms signify. In the first part, in the first point, the age is definitely fundamentalist. That will perhaps surprise you, I have to give now a precise meaning to the term fundamentalism. all symbolisms concerning the existence of man, such correlations as time and eternity, immanence and transcendence, and so on, all such correlations express always experiences of participation in something that is not world immanent. Experiences of participation. These experiences of participation produce their symbols on occasion when somebody has them and expresses them by language symbols. And when these symbols are created, once that has happened, and a group forms to which such truths found by experiences of transcendence is communicated, then this truths must be translated into propositions with a subject and a predicate, what we call a doctrine or a dogma. If for no other purpose than for pedagogical reasons, for initiation, for catechumens, and so on. Once they are translated into propositions of the same type as the propositions by which we refer to objects in our world of sense perception, they are exposed to a misunderstanding, because the realities to which they refer do not have the mode of being of objects in our world of sense perception, and therefore anybody, say for instance a British analyst, has easy play to explain that they cannot be verified or falsified, and therefore are meaningless. Now, this doctrinal phase, fideism, it is called, to distinguish it from faith, has been, you might say, the great disease, especially of the 18th century. It was a great crisis in Christianity that both Christian churches, the Protestants as well as the Catholic, had become dogmatic to such a degree that the original experiences which engender symbols of transcendence had been lost from the cultural environment and were simply unknown to the mass of the people who, if they believed anything, believed in the word of the dogma. Against this situation came then the revolt in the form of Enlightenment philosophy, which, however, expressed itself again now in a new dogma, because the dogma seemed to be the only way in which a truth could be expressed. So when you look at one of the great ideological thinkers like Auguste Comte, in the first lecture of his Philosophie Positive, he will tell you that the dogma of the Christian Church has now to be replaced by what? By a new dogma, the dogma of positivism. So, to replace, you might say, a Christianity that has degenerated to dogmatic formulations by new dogmatic formulations, which again did not recover any original experiences, that was a transition into ideology, so that ideologists are doubly fundamentalist. First, because they assume that philosophy and theology and Christianity are propositions concerning a truth, that they are dogma, and second, that they have to imitate that dogma by giving an alternative dogma. So they fight one fundamentalism by another fundamentalism, their own. So in this sense, our age is fundamentalist. It doesn't matter which kind of fundamentalist you are, if you say God exists without knowing why you say it, or if you say God does not exist, again without knowing why you say it. William James already has brought to attention that the dogma of no God is just as much a dogma as the dogma of God. Neither of them is any good in terms of original experiences of faith. So this fundamentalism is the first characteristic of the age, of the intellectual characteristic. The second is, as you can easily see already implied in this, when one does no longer know what existential relations and the tension of time and eternity are, and when the symbols expressing such tension have lost their meaning, that a lot of reality, areas of reality, language symbols expressing these areas of reality, are lost. One does no longer understand them. Now, that is called, I'm afraid I cannot use any other term, illiteracy in meta-spiritual. So we are living in a highly illiterate age. Spiritually illiterate age, and also intellectually illiterate, because in intellectual matters one must know the difference between a dogma and original experiences of the tension and original symbols and so on. I'll come to them later. So illiteracy with regard to whole complexes of human achievement and discovery in meta-spiritual, prophetism, philosophy, Greek tragedy, and so on. Illiteracy with regard to such phenomena. And then we have that problem of deculturation. Our whole Western civilization rests on acculturation from the Mediterranean cultures, having developed it further. But it is, the basis is Latin civilization, Roman civilization, Greek civilization, then renewals and further acquisitions beyond the somewhat limited ones in the early Middle Ages by humanism in the Renaissance and so on. And a good deal of this enormous mass of acculturation of Western society is in our time deliberately destroyed by declaring this part of our culture either irrelevant for our purposes, or by denying the knowledge of the instruments by which one has access to them, to these parts, as for instance the denial to teach languages in the colleges and so on. So in this sense, we are living also in a period of deculturation as distinguished from a period of acculturation roughly up to the 16th, 17th century. Now, what is the result of these characteristics of the fundamentalism, of illiteracy, of certain deculturation phenomena? The result is a peculiar spiritual state in the Western world, which one might call perhaps by the name of apocalyptic effervescence. People who have lost contact with the reality of existential tension, who do no longer understand their symbolism, still are human beings who are living in that existential tension, but cannot give expression to it, either in adequate language or in adequate liturgies or in any rituals which keep alive the sense of such existence. So this reduction of an expressive tension to an inexpressive, amorphous one, that is what I would call this apocalyptic effervescence, which has the result of a very mixed state. On the one hand, of men being frightened because they don't know what is the sense of their existence. On the other hand, they being extremely expectant with regard to something glorious to happen and a perfection in this world. So in this dilemma between being frightened and being expectant of great things, these two moods, one might say, are characteristic of the time. You can diagnose what is going on here, for instance, by taking a definite symbol which expresses situations of disorientation. For instance, the symbol alienation. The symbol alienation means originally and right up into the early 17th century that a man feels himself not quite at home in the world, because this world does not provide a habitat in which he can be truly man, which means living with the sense of tension towards eternity. That means alienation, an alienation from the symbolism of eternity. In the 19th century now, the term alienation has received, especially through Marx, an entirely different meaning. Alienation now means that a man does not have his full stature and is therefore a stranger in the world in which he lives, because that what he expects from an apocalyptic perfection through a revolution has not yet arrived. So we have here the meaning of alienation as an alienation not from God, as for instance it was with Plotinus, who used the term for the first time for that purpose, but alienation from an apocalyptic expectation to be achieved by revolutionary action. So the proper expression for dissolving an alienation under the direction of expectancy is to make a revolution that will bring about a perfect realm of one description or another. But at the same time, of course, since a man is a man and remains a man, as every man is, living in such expectation of apocalyptic revolution means the actual estrangement from the tension towards God and towards eternity. So he lives in a double sort of alienation, the one of being lost and frightened because he is not in the normal relation towards eternity, and the other because he has already a substitute relation for eternity, the revolutionary expectation which can't be realized either. So here you have this double, this dilemma between being frightened and being expectant in this very concentrated phenomenon of alienation, which is so peculiar to our time, that just everybody talks about the stranger in the world, the alienation phenomenon, and so on. So that's how I would characterize the situation in general. But now that requires a bit elaboration. I've talked about that problem of the 18th century, where the dogmatization of philosophy and Christianity has come to a head, where a break was practically inevitable and actually did occur in the form of the Enlightenment rebellion, the French Revolution, and so on. By that time, there was created, for the purpose of expressing the situation, the new vocabulary that has become crystallized then in the famous law of the three phases by Kant, and in this form has become, you might say, the standard ideology of every enlightened intellectual up to this day. That is, that we had a past in which mankind had a theological phase, followed by a metaphysical phase, and now we get into the phase of positive science. There is something true in this law of the three phases. What is true in it is the correct description of the generative forms of philosophy and Christianity. We must always realize that, for instance, when Kant rails against metaphysics, or when a contemporary positivist or British analyst rails against metaphysics, he is absolutely right. But one must also know that the term metaphysics was introduced, or was coined for the first time, as a science of substances, highest principles, and so on, by the Arabs, chiefly by Avicenna, and introduced into the Western vocabulary by Thomas in his preface to his translation of Aristotle's Metaphysics. In antiquity, in Aristotle or in Plato, there is no metaphysics. The term metataphysica, the title of Aristotle's works, doesn't mean metaphysics, but probably only concerns only the placing of the book of that name after the physics. The content of the book that today we call metaphysics, is a theology. That is what Aristotle called it. So here we have a theology. That is the content of classic philosophy, a special kind of theology. Coming then under the title of metaphysics when the content has been translated into proposition which no longer can be verified or falsified. So metaphysics is a phenomenon which becomes an important phenomenon since the 13th century, achieves then in very few centuries then a crisis in the 17th century with its translation into systems beginning with Descartes, and then the revolt against metaphysics as a system. So I would quite be on the side of Kant in his revolt against metaphysics, provided we know what he means by metaphysics. He means this metaphysics which has arisen since the 13th century. He does not mean philosophy. Now comes again the illiteracy problem, that is a very important problem in the modern period, that he just didn't know what philosophy is. It was impossible to know that at that time. Today we have quite different possibilities again of recovering the meaning of philosophy, but Kant didn't have them. So he thought metaphysics is philosophy, and he was against this dogmatized perversion of philosophy. Rightly so. And in the same manner, he was against theology, meaning by theology what also the philosoph in the 18th century meant by theology, that is, not the Platonic theology. Plato was the man who coined the word theology, the theologism. He was the first to use it. But doctrinal form of the type of doctrine which you find for pedagogical reasons, for instance, in a catechism. But not, say, the theology which you find in a concrete revelation experience expressed, say, in the Thornbush episode in Exodus of the revelation to Moses. That is not theology in the doctrinal sense, but here you get actually the symbolism of the confrontation in a spiritual experience with the God who speaks to you. That's something entirely different. Now again, Kant had to be against theology without being against faith, and because he did not know what faith and what original experiences of a revelatory type are at all. He had no possibility ever to know it. So this very narrow horizon of illiteracy has determined certain front lines and lines of aggression which still prevail from the 18th and early 19th century right to the present in our intellectual community. These dogmatic developments of a fundamentalist time bring now about quite definite constellations in history when the conflicts arise. And we have two such enormous conflicts, the one in the 16th century, the other one in the 20th century, since there are major Western disturbances, assuming the form of world wars, you might say, but due to conflicts between dogmas. I shall speak of them as dogmatomachy, by the struggles of or battles, actually bloody wars, between the representatives of dogmas, who as human beings are not so far from one another, but no longer are in possession of their human reality, but believe it adequately expressed by a highly degenerative dogma. In the 16th century, we have the beginning of the great wars of religion. There were 8 religious wars in France between Catholics and Protestants. And in this situation then arose a figure who is, you might say, intellectually and spiritually, the dominant figure of the 16th century, that is Jean Bodin. Jean Bodin was a man who understood that the conflict is due to the fact that people are living in the degenerative state of dogmatism, and that one could have peace among these warring factions only by excluding the dogma from public status, denying it recognition, and that, in his opinion, could only be done, very similar to the Platonic problem of the philosopher King, if the king were not a dogmatist of either the Catholic or the Protestant persuasion, but what has one to be in such a situation, is a situation of this kind that occurred before, he has to be a non-dogmatic mystic. Then, of course, thought of himself as such an advisor. Now, that gives you, some idea of the changes in the configuration of that problem. The earliest such double situation was late in the 5th century, when the Pope Gelasius distinguish the spiritual and the temporal powers, with the Pope as the head of the spiritual order, the Emperor as the head of the temporal order. That lasted through the Middle Ages up to 1300, when Dante brought the first transformation. He left the Emperor as the head of the temporal order, but replaced the Pope. At that time, the crisis was already so deep, by a philosopher of the Arabic type. He always mentions Averroes as a type of philosopher who would be the counterpart to the temporal power of an emperor. In the 16th century, we have this dualism transferred to the national scene by Baudin, the king and the mystic advisor. And then in the 19th century, we have it once more, now again already on the level of dogmas, again within the ideology, by Comte. Now the two orders are represented by, for the temporal side, the industrial manager, for the spiritual side, by the positivist intellectual, meaning Comte himself. Now here you have these phases of degeneracy of the dogmatic problem, right to the period of Comte. And here in Comte already a very interesting further development, which still lasts right into the present, because Comte took himself seriously. He meant to be the pontiff of the new positivistic creed and wanted global organization and conversion of all mankind to positivism. And for that purpose, he entered then into correspondence, which always remained somewhat one-sided, with the Tsar of Russia, trying to persuade him to lead the Greek Orthodox Church over to positivism. Then he wrote similar letters to the Vizier of the Turkish Empire, trying to persuade him to lead Islam over to positivism. And one of the most interesting letters, one would like to hear what in that milieu then was said about it, he wrote a letter to the general of the Jesuit order to persuade him to bring the Pope with the Catholic Church into the positivistic fold. So for years, Comte was engaged in highly important diplomatic correspondence to establish the spiritual unity of the Western world on a new basis. But some of it has remained, of course. There were still very strong representatives of the communist sect in Uruguay, for instance, or in the 19th century, the Brazilian Revolution has taken over a good deal of it. In the Brazilian coat of arms, we have still the Ordine Progress of Comte, and so on. He had some successes, which are now today forgotten. But now let's come back to that problem of the bloody wars in the 16th century, the understanding by a great spiritualist like Baudin that the solution is non-dogmatic mysticism, and now the same situation in the 20th century, where we have the wars between ideologies, Western apocalyptic ideas of a perfect realm through reason, Eastern Russian through a perfect realm after an anti-capitalist revolution, elimination of religion in the Christian sense and so on. And then one man, again a French spiritualist, who understands that problem and knows that the solution lies in mysticism, that is Henri Bergson, in his De Source de la Morale et de la Religion. One can get out of these closing periods, this closing in into dogmatism, only by the breakthrough, the renewal towards the mystic experience. Those who are interested in it, I would like to bring to your attention a little book that is very known as far as I know. Henri Bergson, as you know, was a member of the Académie Française. And there, next to him, in the order, sat Sertillange, the Thomist. And Bergson and Sertillange exchanged, apparently while the business was transacted, more interesting thoughts. And after the death of Bergson, Sertillange published the content of some of these conversations, offset conversations in the Académie Française, under the title Avec Bergson, where it turned out that Bergson and Sertillange both were mystics, Sertillange not only a Thomist. And the more comic side in it is that Sertillange apparently was still ecclesiastical enough to trying to persuade Bergson to become a convert to Catholicism, which, however, Bergson with a smile always rejected this possibility. So here we have, again, the battle situation between ideologies, new types of dogma, as against the old Christian dogmas, and the representative, there are of course other representatives, but not of the same stature as Bergson, who see that problem. Now, if you see these two great battle situations, one might perhaps form not a prediction, but at least an educated guess as to how that will end. In the first place, there will be plenty more ideological wars, and then that will probably end the same way it has ended for the two churches after they had swamped Europe with blood for more than a century, their relegation from public status to that of private enterprises. That is what we call the separation of church and state. So that perhaps in a future society, ideologies may be permitted to exist, but not to occupy the public scene, monopolize it to the exclusion of another one, so that we have then private ideological sectarians, as we have private establishments of churches separated from the state. That is a consequence of this first bout of the wars of religion. But no prediction, please. It's a possibility. Now, as against this sinking into dogma, we have then another movement that runs through, I just want to hint at it. The two great ones, like Baudin and Bergson, were not the only ones to see what is going on. That the problem is recovering the experience. We have therefore, since the 17th century, beginning with Descartes, always the explicit formulation that the purpose of the respective philosopher is it, against the predominant dogmatisms, to recover original experiences of the tension between time and eternity, in order in this way to renew spiritual order in the personality and by communication then in society. You find it expressed in Descartes, you find it expressed very strongly by Hegel in his preface to his Phenomenology. You find it then become a major topic, beginning with Kierkegaard in his opposition to the degeneracy of the Danish church, and it goes through from Kierkegaard and into the modern existentialism in our time. And now, let me briefly characterize the peculiarity of these modern dogmatisms which have led to this double alienation of which I spoke in the beginning. Double alienation in the sense of being actually alienated from the eternity pole in the existential tangent, therefore being frightened, and then getting the substitute in an apocalyptic expectation of a perfect realm of reason or of revolution, and which one cannot reach, and therefore always feeling disappointed because you don't get there where you want to get. This problem has again in the 20th century come to its head. It begins in the 18th century. You can see its beginning by the appearance of, or the rather social predominance of, a whole new vocabulary when we talk of man. Up to roughly 1700, when man talked about man, he said man. After 1700 it begins. By 1800 approximately, it is firmly established. When an intellectual, philosopher, professional talks about man, he will use such terms which formerly nobody had used speaking of man as the self, the ego, the individual, the subject, the transcendental subject, the subject of knowledge, and so on. A whole set of new terms which arises at that time, sometimes crystallizing into great philosophical movements, like the ego philosophy of the German idealists, which runs then still into the ecology of Husserl, in the phenomenological philosophy of our time. Parallel with this new terminology in speaking of man, we find then an expression, a new terminology with regard to mood of that existence which is indicated by the language of the self. It's no longer man, but the self. We have a whole spate of new words which were created after 1700, which have become so much part of our language that one does not think of it as Enlightenment terminology, like optimism in the expectation of progress, or when you are disappointed, pessimism, all new words. Then, altruism, the invention of Kant, egotism, terms like egomania, monomania, a whole new vocabulary of mood. And then you have for the designation of doctrines, again a new vocabulary, of which you find traces in one or two instances before, but which on the whole is not developed before 1750 and then spreads rapidly. They are the so-called isms. Again, all these terms which today we use as a matter of course, like monism and pluralism and rationalism and irrationalism and voluntarism and idealism and so on. All these terms have arisen after 1750. Or when today we speak as a matter of course of English sensualists and empiricists, the term sensualism and empiricism were coined for the first time in 1803. Locke didn't know yet that he was an English sensualist or empiricist. So here's a whole new set which interprets intellectual productions in the term of a system and that particular view of the world, again a term which did not exist before the beginning of the 19th century. This view of the world is then expressed as an ism, a body of dogma, in the optimal case then formulated systematically. The system comes into use at the time. That's why we have a system of government. Nobody before had any systems of government. And this whole vocabulary is new. So here is a peculiar contraction of man in the sense that The openness of the in the existential tension is, you might say, abandoned for good because there is no more any contact with it. But doctrinal formulations, of which the origins are dubious or unknown, have these make possible these various formulations of isms in the form of systems. Now, why does one all of a sudden form systems? Why do have men Weltanschauungen, worldviews? Probably the origin comes from the new philology of Indology. It is probably the translation of the Hindu Darshana, which came popular after 1800. Why does one do all these things? And now, there comes to the fore, again in our time, a very peculiar problem. At the same time as these things become predominant in intellectual circles, this whole vocabulary of the self, of the system, of the isms, of the moods of pessimism and optimism, begins among intellectuals the spreading of drugs. Drugs. Opium, marijuana. The first major literary feats connected with the use of drugs were Coleridge's Ancient Mariner, the work of De Quincey, very important. By the way, on De Quincey is now that excellent essay by Hillis Miller in Johns Hopkins in his book On the Disappearance of God. Then by the middle of the 19th century, the matter became completely worked through as a problem by Baudelaire, who himself used both opium and marijuana and described the states and explored the case of De Quincey and so on. And in his critical essay, Le Paradis Artificiel, Le Paradis Artificiel, he shows that only a certain type of people are inclined to use drugs like marijuana. And who are these people? They are the ones who are of a certain neurasthenic kind, who are worried about the state of themselves, the meaning of their existence, who are concerned with the trend of history and where it might lead to, and so on. In brief, he gives a description of the intellectually of a peculiar sensitiveness or sensitivity of the intellectual who engages in planning for society, in developing schemes of the development of history, of predicting, and so on. And he exemplifies then the type of man by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That is a typical case of the new sensitivity, already in the 18th century. And he said, these types of elation, of mind expansion, today we are accustomed to these things, isn't it? The mind expansion towards infinity and so on, the new goût de l'infini, is one of the titles in there. The transformation of man in a man-god, l'homme Dieu, is the title of another chapter in the Paradis Artificiel. These types of elation can be gained either through the type of utopian projecting of the type of Rousseau or of revolutionary philosophies of history, as one can gain them through the use of opium or marijuana. It's the same kind of fake self-salvation. He goes even further than that, in another context. In his great essay on Richard Wagner, written in 1861, he gives three great reviews of the state of emotions into which one gets when one listens to a Wagner opera. It was Lohengrin in all three cases. And he gives the great review of the Lohengrin performance by Berlioz, the French composer, then by Liszt, the German virtuoso, and his own. And then he underlines in these three parallel documents all the vocabulary which runs through as identical, as mind expansion, feeling elated into infinity, feeling a light experience coming into you, feeling certain distortions of a color type and so on. In brief, everything that you can find today when somebody reports something about an LSD trip. Or to give you a last example, which is very interesting, in the third edition of his Will to Believe, William James attached an essay, or rather an essay, you might say a report, on his own experiments with, I don't know the chemical name of that stuff, it was called by the German name at the time Lachgas, a thing used when you, by dentists.
Laughing gas.
We call it in English too. Yeah. He calls it Lachgas there. And this, laughing gas now, he made experiments within the same sense in which then later Huxley made experiments with mescaline, for instance. And in this intoxication with the Lachgas, he then tried to write. And he wrote all sorts of things, partly coherent, partly incoherent, but he wrote. And he publishes in that third edition what he wrote while under intoxication. And well, what do you think? How did he write? Exactly like Hegel. You can look at it. It's really written like Hegel, formulations that could be by Hegel. Which brings also now Hegel, besides Wagner and Rousseau, of course, Kant and so on, into this peculiar relationship of artificial second realities, which replace the first reality that has been disturbed, and which are created for the purpose of giving a sort of self-salvation. Not that it's not an invention of mine, but on this problem of self-salvation, Nietzsche has written amply. And the other day I found similar formulations by Schiller in his great essay on universal history. There he writes, I am developing this entirely phony construction of universal history. He says it's just a wild invention. Because by letting myself be absorbed into the history of a race, which is a construction, not empirical. I overcome the limits of birth and death and enlarge my experience of life to an infinite space. Again, just like a hippie. And why do I do that? Because in that way I gain immortality. And then he adds, the true immortality, as distinguished from the other immortality in which he doesn't believe. Same formulation you could find in Marx, for instance, the Philosophical Economic Manuscript. So, this attempt now, by such peculiar constructions, to find a redemption in which one no longer believes, to gain an immortality, in whose gaining one does no longer believe, and so on. These problems now are coming into view and are treated today by all sorts of people incidentally. I've given you just the great names of the 19th century who dealt with that. Today you have such things as by Huxley in the Mescaline studies, and above all by Zener, the Oxford Iranist, in his book on mysticism, where he criticizes the Mescaline studies of Huxley. So, I think I should close here because I have taken up already too much of your time. You see, we have an extremely complicated situation. So, what sense does it really make to say, is a religion necessary for freedom? Because an LSD tripper will tell you that he gains his freedom if he takes his LSD, and then he gets his mind expansion, and then he is really free. And some of these people You find that in the publications by Leary already are of the opinion that here you have a new type of saintly or monastic existence which should be accorded the same support by the public as, for instance, Buddhist monasteries have been supported in the better times of Buddhism by the Hindu or by the Indian or by the Chinese governments. So people should be in monasteries who want to take the LSD trips and to have their artificial satisfactions which cannot be found in genuine mystical contemplation. But that again is a problem only, I have to come back to that, the literacy and the acculturation problem, because all these people are probably in perfectly good faith. But they have not the faintest idea that besides dogmatic Christianity, we have in articulate form since Dionysius Areopagita, that is since approximately 500 of our era, mysticism. So, when you find, for instance, relations between LSD use or other drug uses and Oriental mysticisms, Zen Buddhism, for instance, or when you have associations to Zen Buddhism, for instance, in such a novel as that of Camus, L'Étranger, where he speaks as a solution and the answer to Christianity, a formula like la tendre indifférence du monde, the tender indifference of the world, which could be a formula which you find in Suzuki's examples of Zen Buddhism. See, probably not influenced by it. There you have the association which show you that what these people want. They have a genuine mystical drive, but which is, cannot be satisfied in a comparatively illiterate and fundamentalist environment because nobody knows anything about it. But then you have also that other problem, which is of great importance. We have studied that problem in Munich, especially as a social problem. There is a difficulty in mysticism and in understanding Christianity at large, to which I also pointed on occasion, that Christianity is fairly complicated as a spiritual experience in symbolism. And as one of our assistants in Munich formulated, Oriental mysticisms like Zen Buddhism are very good for people who aren't bright enough to be Christians. So one must take into account the possibility that with increasing literacy in the formal sense of being able to read, express oneself in urbanization where one talks, so where people become alphabetas, as Joyce called them, not literate, but alphabetas, so where they can talk and have converse with one another, we have a new social stratum engaged in such endeavors, for which perhaps something like Zen Buddhism is just what they can grasp. Of course, they should grasp it directly, not by way of LSD. That is, of course, deleterious. But here, I think I have given you a few points, at least, at some of the difficulties in which we are engaged and present, and which I think cannot be solved by railing for or against this or that position in this highly complicated situation, which may last well for a couple of centuries. There are no solutions tomorrow.